afford to be. This is small town music, this is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis.
And I'm Kyle Dotson.
And Kyle, joining us tonight, we have an, I'm going to say legendary bassist. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he'll be okay if I say that.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would dispute that.
Why would you say no to that?
No thanks.
It sounds old. It sounds old when you say legendary.
Well,
you know,
I think if I said veteran, that might sound older.
Even older, yeah.
Even older.
Yeah.
But legendary sounds, you look fantastic.
I prefer...
This is Rudy Sarzo, by the way. Say hello,
hey,
Rudy.
Hey, Pat, Kyle. I prefer ruggedly handsome.
Ruggedly handsome? Yes. All right. But Rudy, you do look great. And my friend Mike Siegel always says, if you keep your hair and you stay thin, you're always going to be a rock star.
More or less.
And yeah. you look fantastic.
Thank you. It takes a little bit more than that. You know.
Well, you have to have some chops.
Well, yes, of course. You know, I mean, it's... Being a musician, you have to be a musician, of course, but it's, eating the right things.
What, and can I ask that, what does a Rudy Sarzo do to stay fit?
Fit. I go to the gym. You know the gym around where we live? Across from the Costco is on one end, and we go to the other one. Yeah. I mean, the other end where the gym is on the Topanga.
Yeah, I go to a different one, but I know what one you go to. Yeah. You don't want me to say it, do you?
It doesn't matter.
You go to the one that's like three stories.
Yeah, that okay. one, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I go to the LA Fitness that's around the corner.
LA Fitness.
It's on Canoga and Victory.
Oh, okay. I used to go to the one that's on Burbank. Burbank and off of Side Street. And it's been like a whole bunch of different names. I think Gold was the last
Yes,
time.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Rudy, by the way, lives in the same neighborhood as I live in.
Yes, so, I do. Yes.
Because I told him I used to see him at the post office, but I would never say hello because he's doing his stuff. So I'm not going to bother you.
You know, the post office is not like the best social environment.
Right, right.
You know, it's usually a long line. You're pissed off because you got to wait in line.
You got to wait in line.
And they give you these little labels mm-hmm. to write all the information
yeah,
in.
Yeah, put the readers on.
I have the worst. Well, I got LASIKs.
Oh, okay.
But before that, I probably had readers, you mm-hmm. know. And they give you, I have the worst penmanship. Thank God, you know, the book that I wrote, Off the Rails, if it wasn't for laptops, I would have never written it.
No, never. Freehand, forget it.
No, yeah, I couldn't even read my own handwriting. Yeah.
All right, fitness, let's answer that question.
Yes.
What do you eat?
Eat, boy, this is going to be really, people are going to be falling asleep.
Oh, it'll be, they'll love it.
Yeah,
it's a little inside stuff. Then we'll get to music.
On the road, it's survival. You know, not every single destination is going to be final destination when you travel. And we do a lot of flying. Mm-hmm. Not every single one is going to be a major airport. So we fly into secondary markets, airports, you know. There's a lot of casinos and theaters in those cities. And usually the airport is very limited. What they offer, you know, so it's a good meal for me. It's a meal that I do not get sick the next day. You know,
okay,
that's a good meal.
But if you were making a choice, if you could have anything, if you were at an airport, an A+ airport, and you could have anything, what would be your go to?
A lean on show days, a lean burger.
Okay,
and I've been doing that for decades. Show day, it's some kind of meat protein. Mm-hmm. I've tried, I was a vegetarian for about 5 years, and it unfortunately did not work for me.
Okay.
I'm finding ways, because, you know, it evolves.
Yeah.
You know, veganism, vegetarianism evolves every year, just new proteins that they come up with and supplements and things like that. I also take a lot of supplements, vitamins and minerals.
Yeah. And you work out.
I work out. I work out not to bulk, but to basically not break down.
Yeah, burn the fat and stay lean and all that stuff.
Yeah.
All right, cool. That's the healthy fitness part of the show. Now, we're going to get into music. The first thing I want to do, though, sometimes I find that on studio albums, sometimes your bass, to my disappointment, it might be buried a little low in the mix.
Yeah.
So I want people to hear what you do. So I found a clip from the Quiet Riot live album called Alive and Well. Mm-hmm. This is The Wild and the Young. This is a song that you didn't play on the studio version.
Is that on that?
Yeah.
Yeah, which version is it? Because, I mean, that was like really, I remember playing that in just in very few occasions. It wasn't really a part of the
Set.
Of the set.
It's on an album called Alive and Well, and let's hear a little bit of it. You're going to hear Frankie, and then you're going to hear Mr. Rudy Sarzo come in. Carlos.
You know, I have no recollection. I mean, that's not live, by the way.
That's not Alive and Well is not live?
No, it's because it's not live and well.
Oh, it's alive and well. So these are re-recordings.
Re-recordings, yeah.
Oh, you got me.
Yeah, yeah. But I have no recollection of ever playing that. Well,
does that sound like it's you, though?
No, it is me.
It's definitely you.
Yeah.
Well, mostly when I have a musical guest in here, I find that you don't sit around and listen to your own music that you've recorded in the past.
I record it and just move on. I mean, I do so many tracks nowadays because it's, you know, I get contacted from bands, artists from all over the world. And my first thing that I write back and says, can I hear what the song sounds like? Basically to see if it's something that I would want to put my name on it, you know?
Yeah. Kenny Aronoff was in here. He told me the exact same thing. People always want him to drum on their tracks.
Kenny's one of the guys that I do a lot of projects with.
He's a great guy.
But I go either to his studio or another studio.
Yeah.
But I've cut a lot of tracks at his own studio. Oh, he's incredible. He's a monster. So, he does that. I do that.
Yeah.
And so we wind up playing in zillions of tracks.
Right.
Not necessarily on one record, like this Dream Child record that we were talking about that came out at the same time as the Guess Who new record.
Yes. That's your new project, though. You are the bass player in the Guess Who.
I am the official bass player.
That's your
band.
I
took over for the founding member bassist, Jim Cale. Yeah, and I was subbing for him for about a few months before he decided to retire. And that's when I took over. And it's I make all these tracks and I send my track over, you know, it's all through the internet, Dropbox and stuff. And
a lot easier now than it used to be.
Oh God, yeah. I have a little studio in my home, you know, basically just very bare bones, but I know how to get a great sound.
Let's do some tech talk. How many basses do you have at your house currently?
About 35. And I auditioned, I have about 10 go-to basses that are in the room.
Okay.
So when I get a track, this is basically what I do. I know certain effects that I'm going to put on, you know, because it's all digital. So what I'm trying to do is to make it sound analog.
Yes.
So there's going to be something to warm it up, some harmonic distortion and maybe some chorusing to bring out certain harmonics in the strings. You know, the things that back in the day, and I'm talking about when, you know, in the 70s, 80s, before we went digital, that you just basically show up in the studio, you bring your bass, you plug it in, and that's the sound. So now I have to chase that sound.
Yeah.
You know.
So when someone sends you a track and as soon as you hear it, do you know, oh, I'm going to use bass number 6?
Well, I break it down to according to the style of music, I say, oh, okay, if it's like really heavy metal, I go with a preamped basses for the heavy metal, you know, something that's going to cut through, especially the tune down, you know, guitars.
Yes.
So I tune down. Sometimes I tune up. If it's a song is in C, tune down to C, drop C. I actually tune up my 5-string which the lowest string is B, I tune everything up to C. So I'm actually playing in the key of C, but it's up. So the strings are tighter.
Okay.
You know, that's one of the tricks that I use. And I have a couple things, or sometimes I can just even drop C on my Spectre. I have my
now. What is the Spectre? I don't know what the Spectre is.
Spectre is the brand.
Okay.
Like Fender and Gibson brands is Spectre basses. You know,
is that your go-to, a Spectre?
Spectre has the most cutting tone.
Okay.
Of all the is best known as a real heavy drop down D, C tuning bass, you know, whereas the Fenders, and I prefer my Fenders passive rather than with preamps.
Okay.
Even though I have a couple and the preamps are really sweet and nice, if I want to go for that classic rock sound, I go with a passive Fender Jazz. I do have the 59 Precision, which is a lovely, lovely bass.
And has that always been your instrument? For like from the first time you heard music, you were like, I think I want to be a bass player.
First time I heard music, I was in the crib. So I was just banging on whatever toy I happened to be in my crib.
But do you play do you play guitar? Do you play keyboards?
I play guitar. This is what happened. I was doing an interview maybe 3-4 years ago, and somebody asked me basically the same question about how did I start playing bass. And in that moment, I had an epiphany. The epiphany was that I realized that the reason why I play bass was because when I moved from New Jersey down to Miami, back to Miami, where my family originally came from, Cuba to Miami, then we were relocated and we returned down to Miami. Basically, the next building, a building next to the one that we were living originally, right? So it's the same neighborhood. And by then, the Beatles had made the splash, and all the kids were, each neighborhood, each block had a band.
Yeah.
So I was assigned by de facto, I'm in this block, so this is my band, right? So I went to the garage that they were rehearsing at, introduced myself, and I go, and I play guitar. And he says, well,
we have a guitar player.
Everybody plays guitar here. If you want to join the band, you got to play bass. So I realized, wait a minute, the decision was made for me by somebody
by someone else
that I was going to be a bass player. So I was pretty upset about that.
But you're not upset about it now.
Well, I mean, this is like 5 years ago, so I dust off all my guitars.
You know,
I have a collection of guitars, you know. And I started getting into the guitar. But what happened was something interesting that I had never really approached before. It was learning music from guitar players, which is a whole different way of looking at my playing as a bassist, learning from other bass players.
Yeah.
So it was like, wait a minute, I'm learning more about music now than I did when I was, going to certain websites that were just bass player centric. Because a lot of those websites, they teach you technique. And I've been playing for a while. So I said, okay, I got, some certain technique. Okay, it's developed. But what was missing was music theory, harmony, and things like that, which I actually studied back in college. But through the years, I never had to use. Nobody in any band has ever given me sheet music and say, play this.
So you continue to evolve and learn and teach yourself even this far into your career.
It's a journey. I come to the conclusion that, and this is the way that I could deal with it, I am never going to be as great as I want to be, but the fun and the enjoyment that I'm going to have for the rest of my life, gathering information and knowledge, it surpasses what I would feel if I get to the point that I say, oh my God, I am so good right now. No, that would be very sad. Right. Because then what's next? You know, so I'm always looking for the what's next, because I know it's there, because I know I don't know everything.
Well, let's hear a little bit of something from the new Guess Who album. It's called The Future Is What It Used to Be.
Now, there's two tracks that I played on, because I was the last guy added, because the record had a journey of 2 years in the making.
So wait a minute. You're not on every track?
I'm not on every track. As a matter of fact, we have three basses on the record. Uh-oh. We have the original bass player, Jim Cale.
Okay.
And then after that, we have Michael Devin, who is Whitesnake's bassist.
Okay.
And then myself. So Baby Come Around.
Let me see if I have that one on my list. If not, we'll find it.
And Running Blind.
Those are the two you're on?
That's the two that I'm on.
We have Running Blind in here.
All right. Yeah, play Running Blind. And then if you go, I have the whole album in there, so you'll be able to find it. Okay, so here's Running Blind.
Yeah.
I can hear you in there.
When the clock struck 2 a.m., it was time to gather up my pride again.
Very nice. I like this album very, very much.
Oh, it's a great record. We actually played four songs live that we added to our set of hits, you know.
Yeah, because Guess Who has a catalog of hits.
Huge. 17.
17 hits.
Hits, yeah. And four of them, number ones, double-sided.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Like back in the day, you have 45s.
A-side, B-side.
The A-side and B-side were number ones, yeah.
So who's in the band? We got the original drummer.
Yes, Gary Peterson.
We got
D Sharp.
D Sharp is the singer.
The singer, songwriter, and producer.
Rudy Sarzo on bass.
Leonard Shaw on keys, sax, and flute. And Will Ivankovich is also a guitar player, songwriter, and producer. As a matter of fact, he co-produced the latest Styx record called The Mission.
Oh yeah, that's a good record.
Produced it and co-wrote it with Tommy Shaw.
Yeah, that's a good record. I like that one. Let's hear the other song. You got it, Kyle? You find it?
Yep.
We just started at the beginning. This is a fun record. This is a really great record. Now, how do we go about doing this with the, does the original drummer, does he own the name? Do Burton Cummings and Bachman care that this is happening?
The original drummer and bassist, they own the brand.
They own the brand.
Yes.
And so there's no pushback from Bachman and Cummings. They're doing their things.
I have no idea.
You stay out of that deal.
I play bass.
You play bass. Okay, good. I like that. I like that. All right. Now, Rudy, in the Off the Rails book, the first couple pages, you tell a story about getting a call from Sharon Osbourne.
Yes.
Would you mind telling that to our listeners? Because I read this and I was just like,
"No, it's basically
this is the greatest."
What happened behind the scenes, you know, before I got the call is Ozzy and Sharon and Tommy Aldridge already had the gig, and Randy, they come to LA with about less than 2 weeks before the band goes on the road. So they start looking for a bass player, and Randy kept telling them, well, you know, you should call Rudy because, you know, I play with him in Quiet Riot, and he's got all the qualities that you guys are looking for, which is basically somebody that could play the songs.
And this is Quiet Riot before you guys broke big.
Yeah, this is the Randy Rhoads version of Quiet Riot.
Randy Rhoads version.
That's what everybody calls that.
Yes.
The Randy years. And basically, they were looking for a musician that could be a cool hang in the bus, because we're all traveling in the bus, you know. and also not be a bad influence on Ozzy.
And were you a clean guy back there and straight and the straight and narrow?
I was a starving musician. Mm-hmm. Even if I wanted to be a drug addict, I didn't have
the money for it.
I didn't have the money. So it's like, but that wasn't the reason I was in LA. Actually, if I wanted to do drugs, I would have stayed in Miami. That's what the drugs are and the booze and just. But I didn't want to do that. No, I wanted to be a recording artist. And I spent about a couple of years or more in LA in the scene. I was living right off across the street from Tower Records. So every day I would go over to the Rainbow and see some of my heroes becoming casualties, drinking and drugging. And I'm going like, oh, God, I'm not even half as talented as this guy here. And look at him. Nobody wants to play with him because he's a liability. You know, so I said, no, don't touch anything. Just, you know, keep it clean.
Yeah.
You know, just because I had a goal. Mm-hmm. I knew what I wanted, you know.
You got to keep your eye on the prize.
Yeah, eye on the prize and no plan B. Just go for it, you know.
So you're hanging out one day with Kevin DeBrow and you get a call.
No, actually I was sleeping on the floor of Kevin's apartment.
Okay.
Yeah. And the way that I could pay for my rent and for that room that he was very kind to let me stay there.
Yeah.
Was by playing in his band, DeBrow. We were doing shows on the weekends at the Starwood mm-hmm. and, you know, these other local places.
Was it cover songs or was it originals?
No, it was a continuation of Quiet Riot.
Okay.
So we were doing some of the most popular Quiet Riot songs mm-hmm. and also the new songs that actually a lot of them wound up on the Mental Health record.
Okay. So you're at Kevin's and you get a phone call. Mm-hmm. And Sharon Osbourne.
Yes, I was laying on the floor, and Kevin knocks on my door and says, "There's somebody calling for you." I mean, nobody called for me. You know,
there were no cell phones. This was like a phone.
It was a real phone, you know. Yeah. And it's like nobody, you know. I was some guy. I was playing in a band called Angel at the time.
Okay,
but we didn't have a record deal. We just hang out at the record plant and make demos every night during, you know, when somebody cancel a session or
then you slip in there.
Yeah. Spec time, they call it.
These are the lean years for sure. It sounds like.
Oh, really lean. Okay. I was about 110 pounds. Yeah. Really lean years. Yeah. And so I get a call from Sharon and I was really happy in Angel, you know, it was like part of my plan was not to be in somebody else's band.
Right.
Was to be in a band. And so when the whole thing about joining Ozzy's band, it was like, okay, I mean, you know, but then again, here I am, the guy sleeping on the floor. And this meant that I was going to play with Randy Rhoads again.
Right.
And, you know, and I could eat. So, but my, you know, shooting from the hip, I got the call and I say, I told Sharon, oh no, thank you so much. I'm pretty happy playing with my band Angel. So he just hung up on me, of course. She's busy. He's got other calls to make. And then the next day I get the call from Ozzy because he said, he calls me and.
So you turned down the gig?
I turned down the gig.
All right.
And then I tell, you know, I hang up and Kevin goes, what was that? I explained to him, he starts yelling at me, you know.
You think you're doing, you're being a good dude. You're like not bailing on Kevin or Angel. And Kevin's saying, dude, you don't hang up on Ozzy. You got to take that gig.
Yeah, you should take that gig, you know. And, you know, yeah.
So how do you get back in touch with, Ozzy called you
Ozzy called me the next day. And he says, listen, we tried a bunch of guys and they're a bunch of hacks. And Randy says, that's what he said. And Randy says that you're the guy. And I say, well, you know, okay. By then I was ready.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, but I wasn't expecting another call. It just so happened, you know. And so I went over and I met everybody. Randy picked me up. Mm-hmm. Off Coldwater and Riverside. That's where Kevin's, he lived in a duplex kind of, you know, where there were like four apartments in this little building. Yeah, still there, you know. And so Randy picks me up and we go to Trader Vic's.
I know where Trader Vic's is.
Have you been in LA long enough to have been to Trader Vic's?
I haven't been there, but I know where it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Trader Vic's and they had the specialty was a scorpion, which is like this drink with like three or four different liqueurs, mm-hmm. alcohol, and a gardenia. You know, so that was the whole thing. How many gardenias can we fit on the table? Make it smell really nice, you know. So, I just, and Randy, you know, he was incredibly helpful. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got the gig not only because he recommended me, but he prepped me in many levels.
Gotcha.
He prepped me psychologically, mm-hmm. explaining to him what the process was going to be like. Because they had to bring somebody into their inner circle. And I say they, being Ozzy and Sharon.
Yeah.
Really quickly. There was a lot at stake with that tour. It was not financed by the major label. It was financed by the independent label, which the family owned, which was Jet Records,
yeah.
which was also the management, you know, and all of that. So there was a lot riding on that record, so there could be no mistakes.
And this is Ozzy breaking free of Black Sabbath for the first time. So
all of the above. Yeah.
Blizzard of Oz tour.
Yeah.
Let's hear from the Blizzard of Oz tour. This is Crazy Train. I mean, Randy Rhoads, Rudy Sarzo, and Tommy Aldridge backing Ozzy. That's incredible. I mean, the first show you did of that tour, did people just go crazy?
My recollection of that first show was like going, and I'm serious about this, was going on a roller coaster ride. You know, when you go, you get to the top, and it's like, whoa! And it was just like that. It was unbelievable. I do not recall the songs in real time. Mm-hmm. I recall them as bits and pieces of things that were flying really fast past me.
Was and Ozzy sounds amazing. Did he was Ozzy in how do I want to, what's a gentle way to say it? Was he not indulging too much on this tour because so much was riding on it?
Yeah, I mean, indulgence by the level of what everybody else was basically doing, or what he had been doing with Black Sabbath. It was a combination of that, and also Sharon basically had a daily intervention.
Gotcha.
With Ozzy. You know, she makes sure that the backstage was clean. Mm-hmm. But then again, he had the option of hanging with the crew. So it was kind of like, yeah, like every day was, she had to really look out after him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you and Tommy click immediately as a rhythm section?
I would say that I clicked with Tommy. not something that I don't think Tommy ever thought in those days of like, yeah, okay, let me listen to what this guy's doing and try to shape my playing. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't about that. I mean, it's like I play with Tommy in a bunch of bands.
Yeah.
You know, and especially around Ozzy, it was pretty much if you get Tommy Aldridge in the band, and this is what you get.
Right.
So what I had to do was basically take the essence of what was recorded and adapt it to the way Tommy played the drums. Because if I played it exactly the way that it was on the record, it would have not gelled.
And is that difficult to do when you have to make those choices or those what do I want to say, those changes, or just go,
no,
you just went
change.
With the flow,
you adapt it.
Okay, adapted. Yeah. Perfect.
Adapted. And actually it also affected Randy's playing, because mm-hmm. Randy played completely different with Tommy than he did with Lee Kerslake.
Yes.
And also with Drew Forsythe, which was our original drummer in Quiet Riot. completely different. What Tommy brought that really altered the rhythm of the band, the flow, the energy, was that Tommy came from playing a lot of stadiums with Black Oak, Arkansas. I mean, yeah. Those guys were huge. And back in the day, they were doing like these tours, like stadiums, right? Which meant that they were playing a lot of shuffles. All that Black Oak, Arkansas, you know, yeah. Go Jim Dandy and all that, you know, right? So with that feel, it's natural to lean forward in your playing. There's three ways of playing drums: in front of the beat, on the beat, behind the beat. And I play with all sorts of drummers that lean in a certain category.
Okay.
And Tommy's was leaning forward. Alex Van Halen does the same thing, you know, which means that if he's gonna be the conductor, the drummer, and you're gonna lock in with him, you're gonna follow.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what Randy did. All of a sudden, Randy's leaning forward in his play, and it's like it was very exciting. And I just joined right in, you know. So it was like this whole band completely leaning forward energy-wise. So it was very, very exciting to be a part of it, and it's exciting to listen to it.
And you can tell, and I have a couple more tracks with you guys. I'll let you choose. Do you want to hear I Have Flying High Again or Iron Man and Paranoid? Which one of those would you like to hear? I'm sure you haven't heard it in a long time.
Flying High, because I if it's the recording that I'm thinking of, I'm playing a fretless on that.
All right, let's listen to it.
Yeah, if it is that version, because I started playing a fretless.
That's fretless.
I just heard the fretless. Yeah.
How can you you just know you can hear it because you're a musician. I'm not.
Well, I know what a fretless bass sounds like.
Now, this is I know you've written about it in your book, and it's not a great thing to discuss, but the day that Randy passed must be one of the worst days of your life.
Well, yeah. I mean, it changed everybody.
Yeah.
Not only that it changed everything, it just, it had one of those effects that psychologically you learn to live with it, but you're never the same again. You just learn to live with what happened because you must move forward. And most important, you know, and this is something that I did not understand at the time that it happened, the importance of the ones who are left behind to actually, it's our responsibility to celebrate their memory, the
right.
ones that passed on. That's our responsibility. And at the beginning, I did not understand that. All I knew was that I was in terrible pain and that I had to move on.
And how long into the tour did this... Did the accident happen?
Well, the tour started, this is the Diary of a Madman tour. So officially in the U.S., because we were in Europe and England prior to that, it started December 30th, 1981, and the crash happened March 1982.
And just a total, I mean, it's a freak accident. I mean, if there's such a thing, you know.
I mean... You know, if you ever get to read the book, it's very easily explained.
Yeah.
I mean, not easily, but detailed.
Yeah.
All the details that, you know, if you follow the details, it's you know, you can see what actually happened. Yeah.
Yeah. And so after this happens, how long do you guys wait until you regroup? Because they bring in Brad Gillis.
Yeah. No, there was no real waiting period. Mm-hmm. We regrouped immediately because at that moment, because, you know, we have been on tour now and the band had a lot of success. We were headlining arenas in the United States and both records were successful, and Ozzy was being established as who he is today, you know. And all of a sudden this happened, and Sharon knew that if Ozzy would just go home, he would have drank himself to death.
Yeah.
So it was just a matter of keeping him busy.
And did she keep it moving? Did she sit down with you and Tommy and say, we have to keep going to keep Ozzy alive?
Yeah. No. I mean, in a way, she didn't have to. There's certain things that she told me. She said, from this point on, you must let Ozzy lean on you. Like the way that he would lean on Randy
physically at the show during the concert.
It was gonna be Ozzy and me playing off each other, and it was like, who am I gonna lean on? Yeah. I have nobody to lean on. So, you know, at that point, I wasn't really.
Needed someone to lean on too.
Yes,
but you were giving of yourself because maybe Ozzy needed it more.
Yes, I was not as mature as and experienced as I am today that I can actually look at those incidents and say, okay, today I would deal with it this way.
Yeah.
Back then I was like, I had no clue.
Well, that comes with experience and maturity, like you said.
Exactly. Coaching, basically. Yeah. You know.
And no matter who came in to take Randy's place for the duration of the tour, because I don't want to say replace Randy, but Ozzy wouldn't have felt comfortable leaning on the new guy. So it had to be you. Tommy's on the drums. It really had to be you.
Yeah. And, you know, we tried it and it was painful. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even look at him. I couldn't even look at the audience.
You're like on autopilot.
Yes.
Until the tour was over.
Yeah. And look, the best way I can explain it is I left Ozzy, one of the biggest bands in the world. They were taking incredibly good care of me, Ozzy and Sharon. I left for the total unknown, which was to join Quiet Riot.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody in the Los Angeles music industry thought that Quiet Riot was even going to sell 10 records.
And why did you leave Ozzy? Why did
you? I just say, yeah.
You just...
It was painful. It was painful
to stay there.
To be there.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So one day, during a break, after Randy had passed away, I get a call from Kevin. Says, "Listen, I'm going in to record Thunderbird, which I used to play with Kevin in Dubro.
Okay.
Which was a song that Kevin wrote for Randy when he left Quiet Riot to join Ozzy. So I knew the song. He says, "Would you like to come in for this record that we're doing?" It wasn't officially named Quiet Riot at the time.
Okay.
You know, the label that they were working with, because it wasn't even sold to a major label. It was an independent production deal. Then it was taken to a couple of other labels, and one label said, okay, we'll take it. And so I went in and I did Thunderbird in a couple of takes. I did it with my practice bass, because all my gear was on the road with Ozzy. And so they say to, you know, Kevin and the guy, Frankie Benelli and the producer, they go, "Do you remember any of the old songs? You know, like Slick Black Cadillac and Let's Get Crazy," you know, things that I used to play in Dubro. So by the time I left the session, I had done like maybe four, maybe even five tracks already,
did these eventually end up being the final tracks?
Yeah, every single one of them.
It's like they tricked you.
Well, no, what happened was as we went along, I started to really have joy playing again.
That's good.
I found my joyful, you know,
your mojo,
the mojo. Well, the joy.
Yeah,
not really a mojo.
Your mojo.
The mojo. There you go. That's a good one. I found again. There was like, here I am. You know, I have been playing with Frankie since 1972, and of course Kevin and Quiet Riot. I live with him, so it was kind of like wow, this is good. I mean, and again, the band wasn't even called Quiet Riot officially. They were throwing around names like Wild Oscar and some of that the producer wanted to name the band. And it was like,
what about the Rudy Sarzo band? Did that ever come up?
No. And so this happened, and it was a few weeks later, I basically, after I fulfilled my commitments, I recorded Speak of the Devil at the Ritz. And that was the last time that I played with Ozzy.
And that was
in 1982.
Yeah. And then when did it officially become Quiet Riot? And
Shortly after that, the production company found a label, which was Epic, Columbia at the time, now is Sony. And it's a Pasha label, but distributed by Columbia, basically.
And then this thing becomes the first heavy metal album to go number one.
Debut. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
That's amazing.
First debut. Yeah. Again, it was a record that even done in the can, master, ready to go with the release date, we could not get a manager. We couldn't get nothing.
It's crazy.
Nothing, because everybody in LA, you know, they didn't believe that that music had any future. Now, meanwhile, I have been touring with Ozzy with bands like Motorhead opening up for us, and Def Leppard and UFO. I have been to England. I've seen Iron Maiden, and I have toured with Saxon, with Ozzy. I knew that there was a new wave of metal happening. Whether it was going to come to the U.S., I did not know at the time, even though Ozzy was part of that movement, you know. And I'd seen sold-out crowds every single night, you know, touring with Ozzy. So there was some hope that something was going to happen.
Well, like, something happened.
You know, yeah, I know, but never of that magnitude. There was like a hope so we could make a living, basically, and make music.
And let's hear, I'm not going to play Metal Health because you don't play on that track on the album.
No.
Chuck Wright does.
Chuck Wright, and he plays on, I mean, it says so on the record.
Yeah, it does.
You know, yeah.
But your picture's on that, and you're on the rest of the album.
Yeah. But it says additional musicians.
Sure.
You know.
But why didn't they re-record the bass part with you if you were in the band? And
Spec, when they went out to get the deal, you know, when they shopped the deal around, they used three songs. One was that, one of them was Come On Feel the Noise, Metal Hell,
okay,
and Don't Want to Let You Go.
Okay.
So that record was done in $32,000. That's it. It was not, there was no room for re-recording. Because again, they didn't know it was going to sell 10 or 20 records.
Right.
Done.
All right. You know? Let's hear one of the hits that you did play on. It's a cover of a Slade song, and this is Come On, Feel the Noise. Iconic. Everyone knows this.
Everybody, yeah.
The album sells 6 million copies in the U.S.
So it's a diamond record now.
Yeah.
It's ten. Yeah. No, it's over 10. It's about 12.
Do you have a diamond award?
I got a plaque at home.
Did you hang it up?
Yeah.
Some people don't hang them up. I've talked to lots of guys. You should.
It's wallpaper. You know, it's like if you're a doctor.
Yeah. Got your diploma up there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when I recorded the bass part for that song, I had never heard the original before.
Mm-hmm.
which was good because I didn't go for what...
Yeah, copying it.
Yeah. So basically I thought, what would Tom Petersen from Cheap Trick do?
That's my favorite band.
That was my only reference. I heard the song and I went, wow, okay. It's like melodic pop, Cheap Trick-ish. So I just... That's what I play.
I love Tom Petersen.
Not necessarily what Tom Petersen did in any other recording, but that was like the only thing I had. What am I going to play on this?
So you guys because of MTV, and you guys have a cool logo, and you have the metal mask.
Yeah, let's go back to MTV.
Okay,
MTV played "Come and Feel the Noise" every half hour. I could set my watch. And I knew it was on the half hour.
And did you mind seeing yourself on TV or did you love it?
I mean, because I did not get to really bask in the success of anything that we did until like years later.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were working so hard to keep moving forward. It was kind of like, you're in the middle of the road and on tour and you're sitting there having breakfast and the manager comes in and says, oh, you guys went to number one. Okay, pass the ketchup. We got an in-store to do. You just, it doesn't even hit you.
Yeah, I bet you guys did tons of, you've probably signed so many copies of that album.
We did because, I hate to say back in the day, but back in the day, we had record stores.
Yep.
And this is the itinerary every single day. Okay, because even if we were on opening up for other bands, and we did that. We did that with Scorpions, which led us to the US Festival.
Yeah, you guys were the first band to play on Metal Day.
Metal Day, yeah, 1983.
Yeah.
Because it was a US Festival the year before, 83. And so we flew in because we were in the middle of a tour, and then we flew right out after that show, so we didn't stick around.
So you couldn't enjoy the other bands that day?
No. No, I mean, we were on a mission.
Let me just run it down. It was Quiet Riot, Motley Crue, Ozzy Osbourne, Judas Priest, Triumph, Scorpions, and then Van Halen closed it out.
That's right.
But you guys came in, did your thing, and boom, right back out.
Right back out. And so the following tour that we did after Scorpions was ZZ Top. Then after that, we did Loverboy. Then they kicked us off the tour.
Loverboy did.
Loverboy.
Because you were hard to follow.
No, I guess it was more to do, it's different lifestyle. I mean, the guys in the band were really enjoying themselves, And
so the guys in your band or the guys in Loverboy?
No, in our band.
Okay.
Yeah. And so right after that, we started headlining a short with Queensryche on their EP, Queen of the Reich.
Okay.
They were a support, and then another band, either Axe or Kick Axe. Always get confused because we have both on tour.
Yeah.
Different times we had Axe. And Kick Axe. Yeah. And,
there's Quiet Riot and there's Riot.
That's right. So. Yeah, there you go. That's true. And then we got an offer to open up for Maiden.
Nice.
And we went on tour with Maiden. And then by the time we followed that with Black Sabbath, that was the fall of 1983, we went to number one.
This seems like a better fit, Quiet Riot opening for Iron Maiden and Quiet Riot opening for Loverboy. It just seems like a better fit.
You know, what we were doing was a little bit ahead of its time. So we were not really super metal like Black Sabbath, but we were too edgy.
Yeah.
To be a fit with Loverboy. With Loverboy.
Yeah.
Even ZZ Top. Yeah. It was, Quiet Riot and ZZ Top is like, no.
No.
But we always did our thing. That's all we knew how to do. No matter who we play with, we went out as Quiet Riot.
When you open for a ZZ Top, does a ZZ Top audience, can you feel if they're into it or if they're
the toughest audience I've ever played?
That was the ZZ Top.
Not just with Quiet Riot. Years later, like around 1994, Whitesnake.
Mm-hmm.
I was on tour with Whitesnake. And I figure in Germany, Whitesnake, big band in Europe, especially. And I go, oh, okay, it's gonna be cool. There's gonna be half audience for Whitesnake, half for ZZ Top, and no.
No. All ZZ Top.
All ZZ Top.
Oh my God, that must be horrendous.
It was definitely the hardest band. And Because, you know, the following is so fanatical, you know, about ZZ Top. Even the women look like the guys in the band.
Right.
You know. And this is during the glam era of 1983. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, no. They all wore flannel before grunge existed.
Right.
You know. You know. And, what was it?
We were just talking about
I
different
things. We
were just talking about opening band. But let's move on to Condition Critical. I want to ask, was there pressure from you guys from the label to immediately get in the studio and get another album out? Because this basically comes out.
Yes, they basically dragged us. We were just getting our engines going for the, we started headlining in Detroit. New Year's Eve, 1983 to 84, with Night Ranger and also Saga and Schoolgirl. Saga and Schoolgirl, I believe they switch over, you know, at different times.
Yeah.
Or Night Ranger. But what happened was we were nonstop. Because most of the markets that we were coming back as headliners, we had been with all the other bands playing there. So, you know, at a certain point is, we're doing good, but boy, you know, we need to give the audience something new, you know? So the record company, they just yank off us off the road and say, okay, you got 6 weeks to deliver an album. Because the album had come out March 16th or something like that, whatever Tuesday it is in 1983 for March. And, by then, it was about a year and a half later. It
yeah,
like,
July 27th, 84.
Yeah.
Not even a year and a half.
Yeah, so it was like, okay, guys, we need a new record. If you guys are going to tour again this summer, which was the whole, you know, that's you guys have to go on tour this summer.
Yeah.
You're going to need to take this 6 weeks off and make a new record.
And did you guys have songs written, or did you have to write it?
Some of the songs were actually leftovers from the Metal Health. New songs like Condition Critical and, you know, things like that. And so it was really an interesting process, but very under pressure.
And whose idea was it to do another Slade song?
Let me tell you exactly what happened. When Come On Feel the Noise became really hot on the radio.
I'm sure the guys from Slade were happy about it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
They were getting some residuals, some publishing on that.
Yeah. And they deserve it, you know.
Sure.
They wrote the song.
Yeah.
Going back to, I was going to tell you about a typical day on the road.
Yes, I'm sorry. And then I interrupted
you. We were going
you.
Tour, get on in the bus. We were driven to a city. We stayed in the parking lot until it was check-in time in the parking lot of the hotel.
Okay.
Let's say Holiday Inn. Go in the parking lot. Okay, it's noon. A tour manager, we're going, get the keys, we're going to the room, take a shower because we have been asleep in the bus,
sure.
You know, get something to eat, go to the record store at the mall,
wow.
Right? But, okay, let me rewind that a little bit. We would drive down straight to do the morning drive of the local radio station of, you know, whatever town we're doing the gig at. So we'd go, you know, do the morning show. And then after that, we'll go to the hotel. Okay. So we get there and all the DJs were going, man, you guys got such a great hit with Come On Feel the Noise. Next record, you have to have another one. And we were like, oh, sure. If you play it, we'll
right.
Yeah. By the time the new record came around and we come up with a new one, it was like, what are you guys doing? What are you doing? What were you thinking? What do you mean we're thinking? You're the guys who told us to make
to do it, yeah.
To do it, you know. So lesson learned.
Yeah. But it worked. It's just Mama, We're All Crazy.
Yeah, it didn't do what it was supposed to do according to the DJs.
Right.
You know? And there just happened to be another band named Mama's Boys from Ireland or Scotland, the UK, somewhere in the UK, that came out with Mama, We're Crazy Now. And a video. So now all of a sudden it's like, you know, MTV, they like to be edgy. So now it's like, oh, wait a minute. Now we have the fresh new talent. So this challenge, Quiet Riot with Mama's Boys, you know, on the same song. So they played us against each other and things like that.
Well, let's see. Well, let's play a little of Mama, We're All Crazy now, and then we'll go into Party All Night. And then go into Party All Night. You guys had these songs that when you look out into the crowd, people were singing along. Because it's like, you just had these choruses and these hooks that were like, that must be cool to look out and see the people just going crazy.
Well, that's
what
you were going for back in the, you know, in early 80s.
Sure.
Anthems.
Right.
That's what we called them, yeah.
And you guys kept, you kept the branding, you kept the logo, you kept the mask.
Mm-hmm.
But the album doesn't do what the first album does.
Well,
just because it was, just because you didn't have time.
It was double platinum. So, you know.
So that's great.
I mean, you can't, especially in a really crowded market. Because,
that's true.
Because this is what happened.
I'm not diminishing it at all.
I mean, this is the reality of what happened.
Yeah.
When we came out with Mental Health, there were no major releases. I mean, major release being that I'm not talking about an EP that was released locally by Motley Crue or Dokken or Greg White or any of those bands.
Right.
Then, you know, we were the only ones with a major release.
Major release
that
label,
became a hit.
A full album.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, all the labels in Los Angeles started looking into the Strip, saying, oh, what else is there like Quiet Riot? So by the time that we came back with the second record, we were competing with everybody else.
Yeah, they got deals because of your success, and now the competition's stronger.
It's coming. It happens every time. The Beatles were the British Invasion. Mm-hmm. You know, the Beatles were a big hit. Well, let's sign everybody else. That's, you know, that's got Beatle boots, you know, whatever. And the same thing happened with Nirvana. You know, Nirvana hits big. Oh, what's going on? You know, Sub Pop. Okay, great. Let's get all these bands, you know. So it repeats. Mm-hmm. It's cyclical, you know, basically. But what happens is you are, by the time you come back with your next record, you're competing in a very crowded market.
Yeah. And then what happens with you and Quiet Riot? Because this is your last record for quite some time.
Yeah. I just had some personal conflicts that, again, I wasn't...
Within the band.
Within the band. You know, I didn't have the tools to actually know how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it doesn't mean that even if I had the tools, the outcome would have been different. But certain things, you know, and actually the reason why I reunited with the band in 97 was because when I left, even though I had major success with Whitesnake, there was still this lingering question in the back of my mind, which is, what would have happened if I would have stayed? And then I reunited in 97, and the band imploded in 2003. That version, you know, with the original members of the Mental Health. And then I got my answer.
Then you knew.
And then I got the answer. I was able to move on.
Because you knew that, originally I did make the right choice then. Is that what you mean?
Oh, no. It's just it's lingering. It's
okay.
Questions. It's answering the unknown.
Okay. Are you a guy that hangs on to like stuff like that? Because if it's, you know, loose ends, so to speak?
I used to more.
Yeah.
I mean, I have less loose ends in my life now than I did years ago.
That's good.
Yeah.
So Whitesnake. This Whitesnake self-titled album from 1987. You don't play on that. The guys that we see in the videos aren't on that album.
No, except for Adrian.
Adrian, a little bit.
Solo on Here I Go Again.
But it's John Sykes and some other guys.
Yeah. So Dan Huff played on that too.
So what is it like to be in these Whitesnake, these iconic Whitesnake videos with Tawny Kitaen, and you're miming someone else's parts, right?
You know that I'm a competitive air guitar player.
No, I didn't.
Yes, I am.
Are you being serious?
I have many awards. Yes.
But now this is almost feels like a bigger deal than Quiet Riot was at this time. Like Whitesnake had been around for so long, and finally David Coverdale is bursting through on MTV. Like I think people thought Whitesnake was a brand new band.
Yeah.
That might have been their eighth or ninth album at the time.
The best way that I can answer your previous question was, this is what happened. Whitesnake was the opening band for Quiet Riot in 1984.
Okay.
And I had experienced the conflicts, intergroup conflicts that were happening. And when I left Quiet Riot, I got a call from their management.
Okay.
And I met with them, and they offered Tommy Aldridge and me to join the band. This is in 1985.
Okay.
And I personally declined because I figure I'm leaving one situation to go into another. No, I don't think so.
Okay.
You know, 2 years later, we actually get the call to go on the video, to make the video. By then, the conflict did not exist in the group anymore. And even the group did not exist anymore.
Right.
So I figure if I would have played on the record, I probably would have not gone on to...
Right.
To be on that, you know, on the in the future of that portion of Whitesnake.
So when you would do, did you guys do in-store signings with that album?
Not as many as Quiet Riot.
Yeah.
Not as many. That's interesting. I can recall, we did a few because I've seen them in the videos.
Yeah.
But not on a daily basis of going every day in the morning to the radio station. And then after that, to do the in-store.
And what's it like signing an album that you didn't play on? Is it weird?
No, not really.
Okay.
Because I'm pretty sure there's albums out there that I'm playing on that people sign anyways.
True.
Yeah, I don't care.
So that's a huge success, that tour. And then Whitesnake has to make another album.
Yeah.
And you are on this album. Mm-hmm. It's you and Steve Vai and Tommy.
Yeah, the reason why Steve was brought in because besides being Steve Vai, you know, a guitar god, Vivian Campbell was out of the band.
Mm-hmm.
And more having to do with Adrian injuring himself while we were in the studio recording. He injured his hand, his wrist, so he was not able to record, to track. And we had a deadline. Again, one of those looming deadlines, like the record has to come out on this certain day because, you know, people look at releases, but they might not realize that everything is done quarterly. And it gets, you know, at a certain quarter, there's so many records of the certain genre that actually get released. That's why sometimes, you know, bands have to wait for the cycle of like, okay, our record is done, but we have to wait 6 months for that quarter to come, and then we'll release it.
Yeah. Because because Van Halen has an album coming out, and we don't want to come out the same time as they
and
do,
also,
stuff like that.
Yeah, Christmas is the toughest one because that's where all the, and I'm talking old school, right?
Sure.
That's where all the greatest hits come out.
Right, with a couple bonus tracks.
And the Christmas albums.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what you, when you go to the store, and there's certain end caps, and radio is playing Christmas music.
Right.
They're not playing, you know, the new releases, you know. So it's not like until the cycle begins again, January, like around, or February around Valentine's.
But this album, this Slip of the Tongue, this came out in November.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the hair is magnificent in these videos, by the way.
Thank you.
It's so gigantic.
It is. We had three hairdos. We had the lobby. which is to go to a sound check and meet the fans.
Right.
Then we had the that evening after for the performance, mm-hmm. you had the arena. Here it is.
It's gigantic.
And if we were playing at a stadium, at a festival, then we had the stadium. Here it is.
Even bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to see you guys.
I remember this before the gigantic screens.
Yeah.
So they had to see us somehow in a stadium. We were like these little figures. So we'd be like trolls on stage, you know, a lot of hair. And that's
well, when I saw Whitesnake, I saw it was, I think it was Bad English, Great White, Skid Row, and Whitesnake. And maybe a band called Hurricane Alice was first.
Yeah, oh, it was that like, in Milwaukee at the...
Yes.
Yeah.
It was like the Monsters of Rock thing.
Yeah, that was the only show that we did with that lineup.
Oh, I saw that show.
Yeah.
You guys were great.
Oh, thank you. I mean, you know, look, you know, playing with a band like Whitesnake, playing with Ozzy, playing with Quiet Riot, it was very consistent.
Yeah, you were always in front of large audiences at the time. You were just like on a roll, Rudy.
I mean, it was that, but in addition to it, the band would always play at a certain level. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like I can say, oh yeah, that we did a show in Omaha that was really bad. No, because we really didn't have bad shows.
No, you just did it.
It was a big machine, and everybody, you know, it's like
and everyone was playing at their highest level.
It was the Super Bowl every single night.
Let's hear on Slip of the Tongue, Whitesnake covers themselves. They do a new version of Fool for Your Loving. Sounds so good. Coverdale's voice is just crazy.
Yeah, he's a phenomenal singer. Interesting. I was listening to the same song today. And
you were listening to Fool for Your Loving today?
Yeah. I was listening to both versions because this is the re-recording.
Yeah.
The original is in the key of G, which was a bluesier key.
Yeah.
This one is in the key of A, but it sounds poppier, more more radio friendly. It's not as gloomy, bluesy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so we picked it up to a and you play different when you're playing a different key. I actually prefer the key of G because it's a blues song, but they were trying to make it more up to date.
Yeah. And may I ask you, why were you listening to those two versions today? What popped into your head to listen to those?
Okay, I'm doing a rock and roll fantasy camp in Las Vegas, and I'm going to be a special guest, and usually I do it as a counselor, but since I'm on tour with the Guess Who, I'm only going to be there for a few hours in Vegas before we do our show at the Golden Nugget on Friday, the 5th, October 5th.
Okay.
And so what a special guest does at the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp is they go and play with every single camp or band.
Okay.
That and so the special guest sends a list of songs.
Gotcha.
And then the campers decide what song they want to do. Then so when I get there, I have no idea. I might be, you know, listening and going over Fool for Your Loving because I haven't played it in decades, and not have to play it.
Yeah.
Who knows? So I learned both keys.
You got to be ready.
You got to be ready because you might walk into a room and they're going to go, oh, we're doing it the original G key. Okay, fine. I know it. Or the A key. So that's why I was listening to both.
That's cool. And is Teddy Zigzag still involved in the rock and roll?
I don't think he's doing this special. Oh, he might. I don't know. But yes, he's still very involved.
I'm friends with Teddy's wife, Lisa. She's been on the show many times. Yeah. I mean, I've known her for 25 years from Chicago.
Yeah. Teddy's been, he's like the veteran. Yeah. I am the second one.
Cool. Yeah. Lisa would always say, you got to have Rudy on the show. And I'm like, well, hook me up with Rudy and I'll have, certainly I'll have him on the show. But
I love those guys.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah.
Let's hear one more track from Slip of the Tongue. This is The Deeper the Love. Here's a question I have. You've toured with tons of people, Blue Oyster Cult and Dio and Ozzy and Whitesnake. Do you ever get a call to read, like there's Whitesnake still exists. Do you ever get a call to go back to any of these bands? Because like Tommy Aldridge is back with Whitesnake.
Yeah, well, he's been back with Whitesnake for a long time.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Quiet Riot was the only one,
sure.
You know, and that was our band, yeah.
And do you feel like when you see like Whitesnake's out there, do you ever think like, oh, I'd like to play with Whitesnake again? Or is that ship has passed?
That would be like me sitting around thinking, what is my girlfriend from high school, who is she in bed with right now?
I love that you put it that way. Okay. That was a perfect way to put it. That makes total sense to me now. Okay.
That would be creepy.
So the original lineup of Quiet Riot did make an album in 2001 called Guilty Pleasures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess we did.
That's a pretty great album.
It's a fun record. Yeah.
Let's hear Vicious Circle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was it fun making this record?
Yeah, it was. I think the band, well, Alive and Well was first, and then Guilty Pleasures after that.
Yeah.
And it was basically the return of the band. It was, you know, I felt like I was tying up loose ends, mm-hmm. like you mentioned before, you know, being back and see how this was going to play out, because there was a lot of hope around that time. This is like around the period where post-grunge period and the industry was beginning to embrace the hair bands,
right.
You know, the 80s bands. There were package tours being assembled, and we were part of a few of mm-hmm. those. And, you know, there was more credibility was being given to the bands of that era.
Yeah.
You know, they were taken more seriously now. And so, yeah, it was enjoyable until it wasn't anymore.
What do you think it is about like the music of that era, the music that I still love, you know, Styx and Journey and, you know, all these guys, and that music is still out there. You know what I mean? And I just don't mean on radio. I mean, these bands are still touring year after year.
Yeah, Styx and Journey, I grew up with that. Yeah. So I would consider it more classic rock, mm-hmm. which is a whole different songwriting
right.
style, you know. Whereas the 80s is pretty much, it is what it is.
Yeah, but those bands are still, there's a version of Quiet Riot out there. Yeah, Frankie's got a version.
I am their biggest fan,
of course.
But if you look at Journey, it's not really a party band.
No.
You know, whereas Quiet Riot was always intended to be a party band. You know, and I think most of the bands from the 80s, like even Poison,
the
party band.
They're still out there?
Yeah, still out there. It's a party.
So they come out in the summer and then people can go and just forget their job or whatever.
That was four hours. The intention of Quiet Riot, even the original intention of Quiet Riot back in the 70s, we were basically influenced by glam rock, mm-hmm. which is, again, it was a form of party band.
As far as bass playing goes, who do you look to? Do you have influences?
Everybody. Everybody. Oh, yeah.
Who's your favorite? Do you have a favorite?
Well, I mean, there's people that I still listen to and I learn a lot from them and try to break, not mm-hmm. really break the code, but more like understand the code. Would be like Jaco. More of the jazz guys, but not just the guys who are great at having technique, because mm-hmm. technique can really fool you. Like if you're really great at slapping, mm-hmm. slapping is really having to do with minimal musical content, you know, as far as what you're actually playing with your left hand. I mean, of course, it's technique.
Yeah.
Rather than, it's more like being percussive. Rather than lyrical and musical, mm-hmm. with a very few exceptions, you know, I would say Marcus Miller, it's the most musical of all the slappers. Guys like Victor Wooten, that's another one. But basically, if you're gonna watch somebody with incredible slapping technique, they're sticking to pentatonic scales, basically.
And what's the difference? Why do some people play bass with a pick and some people don't?
Tone. I mean, I play with a pick in the studio I even audition picks.
Oh, you to see to get the best pick?
The best pick for the song.
You are really deep into this, which is awesome.
I love
it.
You have to. I mean, it's you have to get deep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
What and you play with Tim Ripper Owens, Queensryche. You were great in
the Jeff Tate version.
The Jeff Tate version.
Yeah.
You were great in the Hired Guns documentary also.
The documentary, I appreciate you telling me mm-hmm. that. But then again, it was a subject mm-hmm. that it was very painful for me to talk about, you know.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, it has to be said.
Yeah.
It has to be told, the story.
Right. You know? But you were... but you came off, you know, you came off as, you know, just a great guy, and you seem like a great guy.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, come on, I make a living, you know, with a piece of wood wrapped around me with four, you know, metal strings, you know. How lucky can you get?
Yeah, well, that's what they say about drummers. They beat on things for a living.
Beat on things. It's like God, yeah.
What can you tell us? I don't have any of the live Dio stuff that you played on. What was it like? What can you tell us about Ronnie James Dio?
Oh, Ronnie, you know, by the time I played with him, I have been around for like 20, 25 years.
Yeah.
And I thought, I've seen everything, know everything. But being in a band with Ronnie was a whole different layer.
In what way? Tell us.
Not even professionalism, just the way that... Yeah, professionalism. In a way that, I mean, I'm not saying that the other guys were not professional, but it seemed like Ronnie has something to prove to his last breath.
Hmm.
You know, he has something, a new level to go to. And he was loyal, sometimes to a fault.
Gotcha.
You know, he really... He took care of his band even when sometimes there were certain things going on within the band that I personally would have just lost my mind. He was very, I mean, he took care of the situation, moved on, and never saw him be angry about things like that.
So a very even-tempered person.
Even temper. And, you know, when I started playing with him, it was around the time where record sales were really declining rapidly, mm-hmm. so you could see what was going to happen. But it never affected him creatively. He would be writing constantly for either Dio or Heaven and Hell.
Yeah.
You know, being in the studio recording, it's like record sales numbers really didn't matter.
He just wanted to make music.
He wanted to make music. That's it. Go on tour, you know, be with a band. He had this thing that he would remember everybody's name. And if he plays San Francisco today, he'll come back like 2 years later. You'll remember everybody in that room,
wow.
their name and their relatives, the people that were with them.
And he seemed like he was a very family oriented person.
Oh yes. Yes. Very much so. Yeah. He was fantastic. And the crew, I mean, of course the band loved him.
Yeah.
But the crew, oh my God, they would be, you know, somebody from the management will call up the crew guys and say, listen, we're going on tour with Dio, certain date. And there was so much respect in the industry for Ronnie that if a crew member is working for band X, the crew member will go to the manager and say, listen, Ronnie needs me.
Ronnie needs me.
And they say, okay, go, no problem.
That's great.
Yeah, there was so much respect for him.
I love it. I love hearing that.
Yeah.
And so there's another album that you're on currently, just released. Two albums are released right now.
On the same day, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of them is the band that I'm in, the Guess Who.
Which is the Guess Who.
The Guess Who.
And you guys are going to be touring, tons of dates coming up.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I say the dates?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. We're actually going to be in the Los Angeles area. How far does this go?
This is all over the world.
Okay. So we're going to be in... we're going to be in Northern California. I got all written down here.
Feel free.
We're going to be at this winery Saturday night. I don't drink wine. I don't drink alcohol. So I sure picked the wrong time to quit. You know? and it's on Instagram. Okay, let me open the Instagram here.
I can also look it up if you want me to.
Okay.
Go to the website.
Yeah, if you can look it up.
Sure.
That would be great.
But let me ask you something. Since you don't indulge in
alcohol for over 20 years.
So if you want to indulge in something, what's like a treat for you? A Snickers bar?
Smoothie. Too much sugar. I found these. Okay, I got the dates. Plymouth, California, September 29th at Hellwig. Yes. Hellwig Winery. What a name to have a rock band.
Hellwig.
The Hellwig Winery.
Then Oakland.
Oakland the following day, September 30th. Oakland at Yoshi's. Sushi. Two shows at Yoshi's. And then a couple of days later, we're in Fresno, California at the Tower Theater. That's October 2nd. A couple of days later, we come to our hood right here. We're doing Santa Clarita, California at the Canyon Club. That's October 4th. October 5th in Las Vegas at the Golden Nugget. And then we come right back and the Agoura Hills, the Canyon Club, October 6th.
Maybe Kyle and I will be coming to that show.
You have to, definitely. And October 7th at the San Juan Capistrano.
The Coach House,
yeah. Wow. And that's our California run.
And then you're going to be in West Virginia, Florida, Nevada, Texas, Florida. Yeah, all kinds of stuff. Going to be playing all... The Guess Who hits plus
four new songs. Yeah.
Now, so this other album, Dream Child. Is kind of a tribute to Ronnie James Dio.
Well, yes and
but,
no,
but not. What do no. I want to say? You're trying to capture the feeling of Dio's music.
No, it's actually, well, I mean, that's part of it because
I would love to just keep saying stuff and you just keep going, nope, that's not it, Pat.
No, because I mean, and I can say this because I before I even laid down one note on the record, there was a strategy.
Okay.
And the strategy was to actually not to sound like Dio. And I made a point of talking to Goldie. He said, Goldie, if we sound like Dio, because we have Diego Valdez. He's from Argentina. Wonderful singer.
Great singer, yeah.
Yeah, he's incredible. World-class singer. But he can sound, if he wanted to, he can emulate. I mean, nobody sings like Ronnie.
Right.
But to the untrained ear, it sounds right. like.
Yeah, there's a couple tracks where I can just, for a second, you can hear it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had a conversation with Goldie and I said, listen, you know, if it sounds too much like Dio, this record is going to be dead in the water. So the idea, the intention originally, even before Diego was picked, was, you know, the record company was talking with Goldie because Goldie was doing other projects. And Goldie says, listen, I want to make a record that celebrates 70s metal.
Okay.
That was it. And this is what this record is all about. The intention is celebrating 70s metal. And of course, Ronnie is such a big influence with Rainbow and Black Sabbath that, you know, you can't get away from that.
Right.
But then it also has things like Deep Purple in there and, you know, and so on, you know. And so that was the vision of creating this album.
So I have the whole thing in here. What would you like us to play? Under the Wire?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of like a Deep Purple driving.
Let's hear this. Kyle, I think you're going to love, Kyle has not heard this yet. You're going to love this.
Okay.
Dream Child actually made a video for this.
Yes, we have a couple of videos that we did. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. But, and also the Guess Who, we have three videos.
Yeah, they're all on the guesswho.com. You can see all the, you can get the tour dates there. You can see the videos there.
Yes, we have a video for In America. That was the last one we shot. And then Haunted was the one in the middle. And Playing on the Radio was the first video that we actually released.
Let's hear Playing on the Radio.
All right, hold on. They're not all in this.
It's at the top.
Oh.
Should have been the second song on my list.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Okay, Playing on the Radio, but Rudy does not play on this song.
But I play the radio.
Yeah, and you'll play it live if this is one of the ones.
Yeah, that's Michael Devin.
Okay. This is a great tune. I love it. One of the ones that's in the set list?
Yes.
Because
it's right in the middle.
Cool.
So if you go to the bathroom in the middle of our set, you'll miss it.
Yeah, don't do that, guys. Just stick around for the new songs.
It's a long set, so I would recommend wearing Depends.
Rudy, I really I appreciate you coming down here and talking to us about your great career and all these bands you've been in. And I'm so, you know, I've always been a fan, so I'm excited that you have new projects out there and you just keep doing what you're doing. And you were nice enough to sign a copy of your book, two of these Guess Who CDs, a couple of Quiet Riot CDs, an Ozzy CD, and a Whitesnake CD. And those are going to go out to the listeners. So I really appreciate it. And just pick up this album. This album, it's called The Future Is What It Used to Be. Pick that up. Buy Dream Child too, but the Guess Who is where your heart is currently. This is your band.
Well, I mean, whatever I play on, I put my heart into it.
Of course, of course.
But my commitment.
Your commitment, right.
Yes.
What can we play out with? Well, I had the version of Metal Health from Alive and Well, because you never played on the original. Mm. But, you know, we could also play out with Paranoid from the Tribute album.
Yeah, I'd go with that. Yeah.
Let's go with Paranoid.
Yeah.
Let's do, oh, you know what else I wanted to ask you about before we do that? You're into animal rights and stuff, correct?
Rescue, yes.
Yeah. Do you want to talk a bit about that? Or
yeah,
because
whatever
you want to say.
What I do is very simple. I mean, the closest thing to an affiliation that I might have mm-hmm. with the animal rescue would be with Linda Blair's organization.
Okay.
That's the one that when people ask me, can you recommend something to donate some, you know, money to, I would say, yeah, definitely the Linda Blair world.
And how many animals do you have at the Sarzo house currently?
One.
Just one?
One Yorkie.
Is that, that's your dog of choice? I've seen the pictures.
And she is a handful. Yes. Yeah. So, but what I do is, I mean, I get so many shelters that come through my feeds and mm-hmm. social media that I just repost. And that's what I recommend for anybody to do.
Yeah, that's good. Just retweet it or whatever.
Retweet it and make the world aware of what's available, because you never know who's going to be looking for, you know, for a pet.
You're on Facebook?
Yes, I am.
People can like you on Facebook?
Yes, they can. Yes.
We follow you on Twitter. Where are you at on Twitter?
And Twitter and Instagram.
And what's your handle on Twitter and Instagram?
Instagram is Sarzo Rudy, sarzo.rudy.
What are you posting on there? Pictures of your smoothies?
No. No food. No. I'm not really big about food because I used to be chubskin when I was little. I used to be really fat. So
really?
Yeah, yeah. You know, this is something about when you grow up fat, you always think you're fat.
Right.
Yeah. It's one of those.
Well, you're not conditions. Fat. I'm just going to tell you you're not fat.
Yeah, I know, but hey. my Twitter is at Rudy Sarzo, R-U-D-Y-S-A-R-Z-O.
And there's a cute picture there, you and your dog.
That's our previous puppy. That's Tuca. And Instagram and Rudy Sarzo on Facebook.
Excellent. We are at Rock Solid Show. I am at Pat_Francis. Kyle, you are at Kyle Dotson Funny. Mm-hmm. Go to rocksolidpodcast.com for all things about the show. And once again, Rudy, thank you so much for giving up your time tonight. I really enjoyed talking with you. You are a true gentleman, and it would be insane to be in a room and hear you and Kenny Aronoff just going at it together.
Oh, I have such a great time playing with him.
Where does Kenny play? Does he play in front, in the middle, or behind?
Wherever he wants to.
All right, let's hear some people. They're all playing in front. This is from the Ozzy Osbourne album called Tribute, and this is Paranoid. Thank you, Rudy.